This is CGSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio station at Simon Fraser University. We respectfully acknowledge that we broadcast on unceded ancestral territory of the Coast Salish peoples. We stream online at cjsf.ca. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and listen to our podcasts on SoundCloud and our website, cjsf.ca. Have a request? Text or call us at
Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Aaron Wang, and today I am joined by my co-hosts, Tegan Marshall and Brandon Brownlee. We are starting a new mini-series called An Introduction to Western Philosophy. Now, this is a topic that I grossly underestimated how easy it would be. I thought that it'd be very clear-cut in terms of what is and what isn't Western philosophy with a beautiful timeline where it's just like people fit into it nicely and everyone knows how everything connects. Little did I know that is not how Western philosophy works. I downloaded an Encyclopedia Britannica article, which is 92 pages. So this is going to be a mini-series, and I'm looking forward to diving into all the nitty-gritty details and figuring this out. So I'm going to start by reading the opening paragraph. So this is on the Western tradition of philosophy. It would be difficult, if not impossible, to find two philosophers who would define philosophy in exactly the same way. Throughout its long and varied history in the West, philosophy has meant many different things. Some of these have been a search for wisdom, the meaning closest to the Latin philosophia, itself derived from the Greek philosoph, lover of wisdom, an attempt to understand the universe as a whole, an examination of humankind's moral responsibilities and social obligations, an effort to fathom the divine intentions and the place of human beings with reference to them, an effort to ground the enterprise of natural science, a rigorous examination of the origin, extent, and validity of human ideas, an exploration of the place of will or consciousness in the universe, an examination of the values of truth, goodness, and beauty, and an effort to codify the rules of human thought in order to promote rationality and the extension of clear thinking. Even these do not exhaust the meanings that have been attached to the philosophical enterprise, but they give some idea to its extreme complexity and many-sidedness.
I think the article actually does a good job at summing up the different angles and different perspectives that the Western tradition tries to cover. I think as we start to go through it a little more systematically, we'll come to discover that the central theme of Western philosophy is fundamentally, what is virtue? How does that affect our perception of reality? And then how do we live that out after that? Because that is kind of the fundamental questions that Western philosophy grapples with, whether that's in a metaphysical context or a more humanist perspective.
And later on in this article, they do mention that essentially philosophy can be considered, rather than a subject of study, to be a method of inquiry. In which case you can say that there is a philosophy of art, a philosophy of science, a philosophy of music. And those are all distinct things that are very different areas of study, but they all kind of share this method of inquiry, which we can call philosophy as a method.
I mean, this description kind of throws at you all these, it's the introductory paragraph to the article, so it's going to just kind of bombard you with all these things, honestly, in an attempt to maybe impress you with the Western tradition. But it seems very fragmented. It's easy to become overwhelmed by all the moving parts that are going on. But when I think specifically about ancient philosophy, what I think about is how these parts that seem so distinct probably were actually quite unified to the ancients. So let's just take, for example, an effort to fathom the divine intentions and the place of human beings with reference to them. I don't see that as, or at least in my experience reading ancient philosophy, that could easily be a part of, that could be the project of something like natural science, trying to understand the world as an ordered whole, finding our place in it, and discerning the order of the cosmos as a kind of divine project. So there's all kinds of stuff being thrown at us, but I think it's interesting to go back and look at, well, where are the points of unity here? Specifically, where are the points of unity for the people whom we'll be talking about? It's easy to kind of break things up with our backwards-looking historian's glance. For the ancients, things would have been, I don't want to say like a lot more simpler, but there would probably be a bit more unity to what right. we're reading than...
For the ancients, there was so much of life mixed into this. The Greeks that we'll talk about in a little bit, right? The pursuit of dialogue as a method of understanding and investigating, right? Coming to a sense of what virtue is, what justice is, these very core foundational, both foundational in the personal and the political sense of things, right? That was just life for them. They really can't afford to do anything else. They could, and some did, but a few recognized the need to try and discover, as Brandon has said, why am I here? Well, but more than why am I here? Okay, now that I'm here, how do I live? And that's something that the pre-Socratics and then the Socratics onward kind of deal with in different ways.
And I think to tie this all together, as I was thinking of this topic, and I've been more or less researching and thinking about this, how I would approach this episode for a week, I basically figured out that the reason this is so difficult is because normally in philosophy, we try to divorce the ideas themselves from their context in history, so that we don't have to study history to study philosophy. But I think that's more or less a mistake, because when you look at philosophy and what someone's thought was, it's really hard to contextualize it without understanding the historical context from which it comes from. So for instance, the ancient philosophy we're talking about, we're not talking about any ancient philosophy. There were many, in fact, but the ones that we're used to and are the most widespread known ancient ideas are the methods from the Socratic period. So you have Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Their writings spread basically all over the ancient world and have been used since they were invented basically continuously without break. People have basically been reading Aristotle since Aristotle wrote his stuff down, or his students collected his works. And his works have been translated into numerous, numerous languages. Although, from my study of history, what I know for sure is that it was translated into Arabic and preserved in Arabic and then brought over into Europe through Italy. And from there, it was translated into various different languages, most likely Latin, and spread across the continent of Europe that way. So it's important to note that these different veins and topics of the history of Western philosophy are not just contained in different time periods of history, but different geographies, different places, different countries. And if you've never done this, I really encourage any of our listeners to do this. You can look up a video that shows the maps of the world from like 1500 to 2000, and it just shows like the map of Europe and how the borders change over hundreds of years. And the reason I bring that up is because if you watch those videos, you can see that so much changes in history. Like countries appear and disappear, governments appear and disappear, wars are fought, cultures change, languages change, people groups change. There's so much that is dynamic and complex in history that is carrying over to this discussion. So I'll open the floor to comment, and then we'll get more into the specifics of the ancient philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle.
And yet, I think there's something so profound about what Aaron had just said, that these ideas from these individuals have been preserved and wrestled with for centuries. To see that there is something timeless to this, in my very existentialist vein, tells me that there's something that is deep within the core of human experience that says we desire to know how these people lived and how they operated, not just because we're, you know, kind of, as philosophy students, we're well acquainted with most of these thinkers, but also just because they're, in some sense, they bring us back to fundamental human experience and ideas. Because everyone wants to know what justice is. Everyone wants to know, you know, what their purpose is. I don't think there's one person that hasn't asked themselves, you know, what is my purpose at least once in their life. If they haven't, they're a special kind of breed of human being that's never felt the existential claw knocking at their door. Yeah, I think there's something to be said about how much things have changed and yet how these ideas have been preserved.
Aaron, your point about the not just the history of this stuff being, you know, a kind of sequential, this person influences this person, but the contingencies of history itself influencing the way that ideas are received. You talk about geography. Another angle that I don't know how to start getting into this because it seems like you kind of have to do your own research for it, but it's kind of the book history itself, the way things are preserved. I mean, there's a sizable fragment of Empedocles that was discovered and published in 1999. This stuff we encounter that is so ancient, there's so much in the past, there's so much past scholarship of Empedocles' philosophy that lacks that, and now we have this. It's not like it goes out of date, but it's just to show like there are contingencies in the history of philosophy. Like sometimes we just find this really revealing fragment. Sometimes, you know, Aristotle just gets preserved in Arabic and doesn't get translated until the 12th century. You know, it's a crazy world in philosophy, I guess, is what I can say. And the way that shapes things is, is it just as interesting as the way that they influence each other? I think that is the real meat and potatoes of philosophy. Historical contingencies, they're very interesting too.
I'm going to read a little bit more from the article now. So, it is difficult to determine whether any common element can be found within this diversity and whether any core meaning can serve as a universal and all-inclusive definition. But a first attempt in this direction might be able to define philosophy either as a reflection upon the varieties of human experience or as the rational, methodical, and systematic consideration of those topics that are of greatest concern to humankind. Vague and indefinite as such definitions are, they do suggest two important facts about philosophizing. One, that it is a reflective or meditative activity. And two, that it has no explicitly designated subject matter of its own, but is a method or type of mental operation, like science or history, that can take any area or subject matter or type of experience as its object. Thus, although there are a few single-term divisions of philosophy of long-standing, such as logic, ethics, epistemology, or metaphysics, its divisions are probably best expressed by phrases that contain the preposition of, such as philosophy of mind, philosophy of science, philosophy of law, philosophy of art. Philosophy of art is also known as the field of aesthetics. Part of what makes it difficult to find a consensus among philosophers about the definition of their discipline is precisely that they have frequently come to it from different fields, with different interests and concerns, and they therefore have different areas of experience upon which they find it especially necessary or meaningful to reflect. Sir Thomas Aquinas, circa 1224 to 75, a Dominican friar, George Berkeley, 1685 to 1753, a bishop of the Irish Church, and Søren Kierkegaard, 1813 to 55, a Danish divinity student, all saw philosophy as a means to assert the truths of religion and to dispel the materialistic or rationalistic errors that, in their opinion, had led to its decline. Pythagoras, circa 580 to 500 BCE in southern Italy, René Descartes, 1596 to 1650 in France, and Bertrand Russell, 1872 to 1970 in England, were primarily mathematicians whose views of the universe and of human knowledge were vastly influenced by the concept of number and by the method of deductive thinking. Some philosophers, such as Plato, circa 428 to circa 348 BCE, Thomas Hobbes, 1588 to 1679, and John Stuart Mill, 1806 to 1873, were obsessed by problems of political arrangement and social living, so that whatever they have done in philosophy has been stimulated by a desire to understand and ultimately to change the social and political behavior of human beings. And still others, such as the Milesians, the first philosophers of Greece, from the ancient Anilean city of Malthusius, Francis Bacon, 1561 to 1626, an Elizabethan philosopher, and Alfred North Whitehead, 1861 to 1947, an English metaphysician, began with an interest in the physical composition of the natural world, so that their philosophies resemble more closely the generalizations of physical science than those of religion or sociology. So we can see that philosophers themselves have different types of experience. I think that this paragraph does an excellent job of grouping some philosophers together by some of their common interests. But it's important to note that this can be done in a variety of ways. You can pick almost any two philosophers and find something that they have in common and something they have different. So it's kind of up to the modern philosopher or the modern student of history who's studying these philosophers to decide and interpret where things philosophically link to each other. And that isn't to say that I'm going completely postmodernist here, that there's no ultimate truth at all, but I do think that there is, it is very important to understand the interpretations of the people who are reading the philosophical texts that we're talking about. And as Brandon was mentioning earlier, there, with modern archaeology, we are re-earthing texts, ancient texts, in their somewhat original forms or more original forms all the time. And sometimes the forms that have been passed down and retranslated and translated over time, sometimes those have been reinterpreted unintentionally by people who have been copying them down. And so when we find the original documents, we have to play around with our interpretations again, as the field of literary criticism has, well, it's devoted to that entire endeavor. I did think it was very interesting that there are some philosophers who are asserting the truths of religion to dispel materialism or rationalistic errors, and there are other philosophers who are essentially doing the opposite, who are starting with an emphasis on the understanding the physical world. I know Francis Bacon was a religious person, and that somewhat motivated him towards understanding the physical world, but that is not really necessary. So essentially, there are some philosophers who will defend the influence of religion on wisdom, and there are others who will see it as being less important. And I think that kind of brings an interesting question of, as a philosopher, what's more important to you? Your own observations of the world and your own sense perceptions, or the written works and knowledge that you attain from your culture and the people and the things that other people teach you, that you learn by tradition. So that's and of course how you differentiate that is a matter of philosophy. Yeah. So we're in good company.
I'll let Brandon share what he has to share, and then I'll jump in with my response to that.
Yeah, sorry, I just had to run off because reading this hearing Aaron read this passage reminded me of an equation that W.K.C. Guthrie puts in the introduction, or in the first chapter of his book, The Greek Philosophers from Thales to Aristotle. And he has like a little equation where he says that philosophers do not think in a void, and their results may be described as a product of temperament times experience times previous philosophies, which I think this is trying to do justice to. People have different concerns about the world. They have different projects. They have different passions that drive them in different ways. But obviously, that just covers temperament. Well, and a bit of experience, maybe. But previous philosophies does factor in there as well. The article captures a broad timeline of philosophers. So the Pythagoreans are going to be less influenced by, say, Bertrand Russell, just because there's less stuff to draw from. And so it can seem a lot more original. Obviously, they're still drawing on other things, you know, their own experience and times their temperament. But I don't know. I just had to, that just popped in my mind that there's a little, Guthrie gives a little formula for how to cook up a philosopher.
Let's dig into that a little bit deeper. So can you repeat the formula?
Yeah, so Guthrie says it is temperament times experience times previous philosophies.
Okay, so we have temperament. I think that's interesting because to some degree, if you're, let's say, a very angry person, you may not be motivated to do philosophy. Philosophy does take a certain amount, I think, of restraint, mentally speaking, just to be willing to sit in the void of not knowing something for a long period of time, which I think is not what a more angry or more impulsive person would want to do. So temperament is interesting. Mm-hmm. Experience we've covered pretty well because we just finished our existentialism miniseries. Yeah. Other philosophies, I think that's where things get kind of interesting. And I think it's important to note there's a little bit of a physical law of history, which is that you can't know about things before they have happened yet. So it's impossible for the Pythagoreans to even know the name of Bertrand Russell because Bertrand Russell becomes thousands of years later. Well, so,
yeah.
Please don't deny that.
I will deny that, actually, because that's... I'm going to pull on my Thomas Aquinas hat for a minute and suggest that one of the arguments he would make for God's existence is you can see an organized creation within nature itself. So although you can't physically see God, you can know God exists by the order of the universe of which he hath created. That argument we won't unpack and tear apart because that's not the topic of the show, but I think there is precedent to say you can know about concepts that other authors will extrapolate on way later without knowing the direct person that we then attribute them to. But going back to your question just before before we dug into the formula, I would say that it is, at least in this day and age, it is impossible, almost, to come up with completely original ideas. Because you always, unless you are severely isolated, are going to be influenced by the people and ideas and concepts and structures around you. This brings us back to the kind of core of our existentialism series of intentionality. The difference is whether a person takes a concept and works that out in their mind and adds and subtracts different elements to then give birth to a quote-unquote new idea. I hate to say it because, you know, I'm usually the optimist and all that good jazz, but even the optimist would realize he's only optimistic because of ideas that he's seen portrayed in entertainment or sometimes in real life that defy the common experience. So I don't know if there's such thing as a completely original idea, but maybe perhaps, as the formula would kind of suggest, with those three things of temperance and all that jazz, would suggest is maybe you can have an original articulation of a pre-existing notion or idea.
And I think that there might be some minor confusion that you have taken about the difference between experience and other philosophies. So my point earlier was that, you know, it's not possible for the Pythagoreans to read the works of Bertrand Russell. So they can't be influenced by that other philosophy because it hasn't existed in their time period. But on the other side of things, like Bertrand Russell was trying to deal with the foundations of logic and thought, which is something the Pythagoreans were incredibly concerned about. And it's earlier when you were talking about that philosophy has this eternal quality to it. From my experience studying mathematics really does seem to have this eternal quality to it, that there's this basic idea of like counting that even if you never teach someone ever any mathematics at all, they'll probably still have an intuition for counting at a very basic level. It's just kind of part of who we are as human beings. They might not call it that, obviously. So, and then if you look around the world, there are so many different types of counting systems between different cultures, different symbols for counting different things, but they all are basically the same system. Abstractly, a counting system is a counting system, no matter how it works. And then you get things like the concept of zero as a mathematical idea that spreads, the ideas of multiplication. I mean, these things seem like trivial and easy for us today, but if you look at the history of mathematics, like the plus sign wasn't invented until like the 15th century or so, I learned in my math class by some German accountants. And before that, people just added without using a plus sign. So it's really weird to think about, but if you think about philosophy as abstract ideas that influence each other and grow and build on each other, the modern world is, you know, this super complex web of ideas built on, you know, thousands of years of history that interconnect in a whole bunch of unexpected ways, but foundationally are based off of, you know, the eternal realities of the human experience. So it's, yeah, I can understand now why this is a terrible topic for a radio program, because we just don't have the time to do justice to this topic. All right. I am going to remind our listeners that you have been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I am your host for today, Aaron Wang, and we are talking about an introduction to Western philosophy, a topic I am regretting choosing because of its complex nature and wide breadth. So essentially this includes the history of all of the world or all of Western culture,